there's this ability to sell to someone who's going to listen to more of the nuance. But how do you spin that into a model?
But I really am starting to advocate more for at least operating with the mindset that you never want to raise money again.
Massive raises don't mean job security. They just don't.
They raised $50 million, but now they're out of business, you know, in less than a year.
But the podcasting world just doesn't work that way. Hey guys, welcome back to the Results Junkies podcast. Paul and I are back in our basements again after many, many miles on the road for me and a decent number of miles on the road for Paul. And this is the wonders of the podcasting world. It's actually been a few weeks since we recorded. So since we've had both had vacations on the books, we scheduled a couple episodes while we're gone. So there's a lot to catch up on, Paul.
You know, it's coming back from vacation is sometimes a blessing and a curse. I know you're probably digging out of email. I'm still digging out of email. It just never stops. So
yeah. People always wonder why I like working on vacation. It's just because I hate coming back to a mess. So I do try and get a bunch of stuff done. You know, while I'm on the road, usually just triage.
You know, I was talking to a friend last week, Casey Allen, actually, and he anyway, we were just chatting and I heard something weird in the background. I was like, hey, where are you? And he's like, oh, I'm on vacation in Hilton Head. And I was like, I'm sorry, man. We don't have to do this now. We can, you know, I was just very apologetic. I felt bad because I had pushed for the meeting or whatever. And he said something back that I thought was very interesting related to what you just said. He said, well, I try to block off about 90 minutes a day to just triage email. It's about the right amount where, you know, it doesn't take away from the family. The kids are still young. They might be sleeping, but 90 minutes helps me sort of stay on top of things. And I kind of do it while I'm either walking or, you know, out running or something like that. So I just thought it was interesting that, to your point that sometimes there are benefits to, like, you know, cranking out 45 or 60 or 90 minutes, if only to not get into the backlog or not let the backlog happen.
Yeah. And I think, I wouldn't necessarily say it's the healthiest thing I do, but I also think, I mean, if you just think about family vacations, you know, to Casey's point, I mean, I'm usually up, like, even on the nights we stay up late. I mean, I really can't sleep past 7 or 7:30, and, you know, the kids will sleep. I mean, sometimes even on vacation with time changes and stuff, sometimes they'll sleep till 9. And so I can burn through an hour of work then. And then also too, you know, like I scheduled a couple of calls while I was on, like the ring road in Iceland, because like we're going to be driving for 3 hours. So, you know, I do squeeze it in times when it's, you know, less painful for the family, but does help stay on top of stuff. And to your point, everybody's always really apologetic when in that exact scenario, they're like, what's that background noise? I'm like, oh, it's a waterfall. And we're in Iceland. And they're like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm interrupting you on your vacation. It's like, well, like, hey man, like life still has to go on. And the person that was calling me was actually, it was about a conference that's next week. And it's like, well, if we don't talk now, like you're not going to get what you need. So Triage is exactly the right word. You know, for folks who are just tuning in, we're going to try and cover a bunch of stuff today. I don't know how much we're going to get through, but we're going to update on layoffs, which is a topic that we've been talking about pretty consistently. There's a pretty nasty inflation printout this morning. We want to dig into something that Paul's been bootstrapping. And to that end, if you've got questions for Paul or I, or you want to come on the show and pitch, we are looking for companies to pitch us, you can email us show@resultsjunkies.com. On social media, he is at Paul Singh. I am at Pizza in Motion. And we'd love it if you'd hit the 5-star rating and review button in whatever app you're listening on. So Paul, we talked about this pre-show. Like, I wasn't going to actually give you the numbers ahead of time, just so we'd have an honest reaction from you. And remember that we have, through the first 40 episodes of the show, we have kept our non-explicit ranking on Apple. So no F-bombs. But if you had to guess, it's been about 3 weeks since we recorded together. And layoffs.fyi is a site that we've started keeping track of. I don't think it's an authoritative list, but it's a pretty solid tracking of what's going on in the world in terms of layoffs. How many companies do you think have announced layoffs in the last 3 weeks, roughly?
I'm gonna just say 50.
That's probably where I would have guessed. I wished I'd written down a number before I looked. It was 129.
Wow.
And some of them don't list the numbers of employees, but for ones that do list the number of employees, it's over 10,000 total employees. And you know, the two biggest ones were GoPuff and Butler Hospitality, who we're hoping to have some time to talk about. You know, as we get through the show, I do want to talk about Beacon, the project that you're bootstrapping. But I mean, there's numbers here. There's names here people know: Twitter, Shopify, Canoe, Celsius. I mean, GoPuff. You know, these are, I wouldn't necessarily say all household names, but they're real companies.
You know, I want to be respectful of the people that are affected by all this, but I'm also compelled to just say something that we talked about quite a bit on the tech tour a couple of years ago, that I think it's important to remember that people think that having a job is safer than the alternative. And, you know, just listening to the numbers you just mentioned and the names you just mentioned, that's just not true. In fact, you know, entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial thinking is probably safer than that W-2 paycheck you have. I think the blunt way that I like to say this to people is who do you trust more, yourself or your boss? And so anyway, I want to be like really respectful to people that are affected by this, but you know, at the same time, like it's hard to kind of, you know, well, I'll just say what I want to say and hopefully I won't get in trouble for it. Look, I think I've been scrolling, you know, it's not hard. Your LinkedIn feed probably looks just like mine, where, you know, day in, day out, somebody's posted something like, hey, I'm sad news to share. Me and 200 other people got laid off today. Please like and share this. We're all, you know, and you want to help them, right? But like,
sure.
In those same posts, they say, yeah, I joined the company like 9 months ago, or it's been a great 15 months or whatever. And so maybe this is all anecdotal, but a lot of these people joined these high flying unicorn, decacorn kind of startups within the last year or two, bolstered by how much money these companies had raised and all that. I guess the blunt thing I just want to ask is like, what were you thinking? I mean, you know, putting aside like compensation, all that stuff for just a moment, how much more upside did they think there was on these things? Like, you know, it's, I don't know, maybe it's just a gross misunderstanding of venture capital. And, you know, maybe people think that, oh, they raised $500 million or $100 million, they're going to be safe. But, you know, some of the names that you and I talked about in the pre-show here, it's like, they raised $50 million, but now they're out of business, you know, in less than a year. It's just wild. So anyway, I guess the main thing here is I think it's a reminder that employees should do more diligence on later stage venture-backed companies, not less, when they're thinking about joining.
Yeah, and you used to say that on the road all the time. And I remember in the beginning of the tour when you would say, you know, you felt it was safer to bet on yourself than to, you know, work for a big company. I wouldn't say I disregarded it, but I can't say I agree with it 100%. And I think as time has gone on and the big employers have shifted in that, you know, it's not all just, you know, Wells Fargo and GE that are hiring people. And even those big companies, I mean, we saw Google announce that they were slowing down hiring. So, you know, I think as time has gone on, I've definitely slid more over into that point of view that, that betting on yourself may be a better bet. And I, you know, still not necessarily that way for everyone. I think you've always made the comment about it's always good to be looking at, side hustles. I hated that term because I think it cheapens what people come up with for great projects. And I think like that's why we're going to talk about Beacon a bit, because Beacon's a quote unquote side hustle for you. But I mean, I think it could be something pretty spectacular. You made one other comment there that I really want to focus on, because I think it's a pinpoint. And for anybody that's listening, that's thinking about evaluating a company, just because they raised cash, and we're seeing this almost every day now, massive raises don't mean job security. They just don't. Not unless these companies right-size their burn before they make that raise. So I think, Jake, you know, to your point in the pre-show, you said something that I think is so key, which is you should be doing your due diligence.
Yeah, I mean, I'm only 41. I don't feel old or anything like that. But I have noticed that my thinking about, you know, venture has changed over the years. And I realize that's ironic considering you know, some of the investing that I'm doing and stuff like that, and that we're doing, you know. But at the same time, like, I don't know, the older I get, the less interested I am in, you know, propagating this myth that somehow venture funded companies are safer. Because I admit, you know, I probably had something to do with it too, you know, when especially when I was on the venture side, you know, investing as a full-time job, you know, a decade ago, I pumped it too, right? You know, startups are everything, venture is everything. But, you know, I don't know. I like what you said there about, you know, the phrase side hustle sort of cheapens what people are actually doing. And I think, you know, it's important to understand that everything kind of starts that way. I think there's this narrative that entrepreneurship is about, you know, kicking the proverbial stapler off your desk and jumping off of it and telling your boss to stick it wherever and then jumping in with 2 feet into this new thing. It's not that at all. I mean, you know, every great company kind of starts out as a joke. It sort of starts out as like this thing that somebody was tinkering with. You know, I remember at one point, so across the Results Junkies portfolio now, which, you know, again, spans 10 or 12 years now, I think I counted something like 51 unicorns now that are still alive, you know, and so like a couple months ago, I was talking to somebody else and we were talking about these sort of what some of those names were. And she said something that I thought was a little bit, you know, typical. But anyway, I said, well, look, here's the thing. Every great company starts out as a joke. People laughed at it, you know, people laughed at these things. So anyway, I know I'm going long on this, but I really like what you said there. I think the phrase side hustle cheapens what actually is happening. In fact, every great thing starts that way. I mean, you can't get to $1 million a year without breaking a dollar first, which I think, as I say that out loud, seems really simple, seems very obvious, but at the same time, it's not. I mean, you probably know just as well as I do how many people we met along the road over the years that thought venture capital was something else, thought startups were something else. And I don't know, it's just, anyway, well, I don't know where you want to take this because I could kind of ramble on about this for hours, but I guess I'll just end this part of what I'm thinking by saying that, like, as I get older, I fully admit that I'm sort of steering people more towards like the bootstrapping side and even steering people that have raised money into thinking and operating as if they will never raise money again. We both know that, like, once you step on the venture treadmill, you're going to keep raising money. It's just sort of how the game works. But I really am starting to advocate more for at least operating with the mindset that you never want to raise money again.
Yeah, and that's one point I've never really agreed with you on, which is this philosophy of that once you're on the treadmill, you never get off. I feel like, you know, I wouldn't say this is an all or nothing thing either. I think to your point, the what you summed up in the last bit there, which is if you're getting on the treadmill, you should have a very clear picture on how you're going to move forward and when or if you're going to get off. And I think, you know, this goes back to this philosophy that you mentioned on bootstrapping. And I think, I think this recession will likely teach a lot of founders the value of having the right amount of burn and having a sustainable business model. And I think I don't want to get all kitschy and say, like, you know, you learn so much when you bootstrap something and you come from nothing and you don't have the cash and all that, you know, but in reality, I think that, you know, like, you and I have had half a dozen conversations about Beacon, which is the podcast project that you've been working on. And, you know, I mean, like, if you had unlimited cash at this point to put into Beacon, I don't necessarily know that you'd be further along because you're a smart guy who understands how to test and iterate, stuff like that. And that's like, maybe having cash would have helped with that a bit, but it's still all about your critical thinking process at the end of the day. And I still contend, and I think you and I agree 100% on this last bit, that fundraising is the biggest mind drain every founder goes through. It is an unbelievable time suck.
It's a huge time suck. Yeah. Yeah. And I agree with you, by the way, that I think you know, with regard to Beacon, I think that had I raised money, I don't think I would have been moving any faster. One of the things I've always said, and I'm trying, I realize with like these little sound bites, it's going to make me sound a little, you know, I don't know what the right word is here, but look, I think that raising money only accelerates the inevitable, or raising money already, raising money for your company or your idea is only going to accelerate what was already going to happen. So it's either going to accelerate the failure or it's going to accelerate the success. And so maybe the subtle but important way to interpret that is that it really is about the founder or the founders. And this applies to that side hustle that, you know, somebody's working on. It applies to that company you're working on. It applies to everything. But you know, this sort of, you know, maybe this is a good segue to that other topic I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on, is that, you know, with, and I'll just use Beacon as an example here, because so just for, if you're new to the podcast here, Beacon is a side project I started a couple of weeks ago where I wanted to build a full transcript search of all podcasts. And what came out of that is, in addition to that, is a trending topics engine that sort of is starting to show some promise. And I'm hoping to have a sign up for people to be able to use it later this week. But okay, so on a personal note, building Beacon has been fun because it's forcing me to learn things. And I don't know if you know this about me, but back in 2008, when I wanted to make my first angel investment, I didn't know how to do it. And so I used to hang around on a message board called Hacker News. And back then, I sort of committed on Hacker News that I was going to build one new thing every month and launch it on Hacker News in my, you know, journey of learning how to use or how to write with Ruby on Rails back then. And like 9 out of 10 of those projects that year totally bombed. One or two of them actually went on to make some pretty good side money for me. One was like a notary, like a CRM for notary publics. And that was kind of cool. And another one was actually a PDF to mail API. So like actual fit, like you upload your PDF and it spits out letters from that I was sending from my house. And I ended up talking about it on Hacker News, and lo and behold, not only did I learn how to use Ruby on Rails, and not only did I, you know, get one or two of those projects to make me some money, but I actually started meeting really interesting people that I ended up investing in. And so anyway, I tell you that because now fast forward 12, 14 years, I'm kind of doing it again. And so on a personal note, Beacon is a good way for me to learn sort of what the new technologies are these days. And I sort of tweeted about this the other day that I think it's so fascinating what a solo developer can do now. It's just wild. I don't think I would have been able to build what I've built so far 10 years ago. But like on the other side, I guess on the professional side, it's also forcing me to kind of question a lot of the ideas that I've been thinking about over the last couple of years and what sort of founders to invest in. Because to your point, money would not make this project move any faster. But yet, the thing that I've been thinking a lot about is, you know, how do you bootstrap companies where the cost to start is non-zero? And that's not a really well-formed thought yet, but let me kind of rephrase it, and then I'd love to hear what you think. You know, I think that in broad strokes, I used to think that there are two kinds of companies. Companies that need more than $1 million to get their first customer, and or not. I thought of it as a very binary thing, you know, and just loosely here, the way I would think about that is like, you know, when I was angel investing a lot, I would say, gosh, if you need more than $1 million to get to your first customer, I'm just not the right investor for you, you know, because that would block out, like I don't do a lot of investing in pharmaceuticals or biotech or whatever. Those are important fields. I just can't afford to be in them. But working on Beacon sort of making me think that maybe there's like a, it's not binary. There's companies that do require more than $1 million to start or hit their first customer. But maybe there's companies that require like 10 grand to hit their first customer. And then there's ones that are less. And, you know, maybe those stop points are not the right points. I'm just saying that I've gone from thinking that in a few short weeks, I've gone from a decade or more of thinking that there were only two kinds of companies, right? $1 million or not. And now in the last couple of weeks, I'm kind of thinking like, maybe there's a third, like a three-way to look at this. And Beacon's kind of in the middle because it's computationally expensive, to transcribe. I mean, we're talking millions of hours of podcasts that are getting pushed out every week, and it has to get transcribed. And it's a chicken and the egg thing, because I got to go transcribe them, index them, before you, for example, would get any value out of them. So now that I've rambled all that out, I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are on, like, you know, if we kind of look at this from the framework of, like, maybe there are three kinds of companies, the companies that you could theoretically start with whatever you already have or little to no money. And on the other extreme, there's companies that require $1 million or more to get to their first customers. But this new, like, middle ground, I'm curious what your thoughts are on how you would bootstrap that. So let me pause there. Does that question kind of make sense?
It does. And I think, I think this niche has existed for a while, but it wasn't well enunciated in the venture capital stack, if you will, because it was like, well, like a term sheet has to be, you know, you got to raise at least, $200,000-$300,000, and the valuation's got to be at least, $3 million. And obviously those numbers have changed drastically in the last few years, and now they're headed back down.
Yeah.
But I think, I think the thing that's unique about what we're talking about with Beacon is that, at least on its face, I don't see an obvious, like, with a lot of the things that we talk about that are smaller, or the, when I say smaller, I don't mean smaller in terms of, like, not a big idea, but just in terms of how much cash they need. A lot of them seem like they're complementary to something else that's out there. And I think the thing about Beacon that's interesting to me is that, certainly I think there are a number of different ways it could go, because I'm very interested in the podcast space in general, and how people use it as a medium for storytelling. But it's not obvious to me that there's no obvious acquisition targets that you're looking at, like, well, we could be a bolt-on to X, or we could be a bolt-on to Y. Certainly, like, we could sit down and think of those things. But I think Beacon's the sort of thing that was it Banana Tag? Was Kelowna? The Gmail plugin things. Yeah, like, uh-huh. I think there's certainly there were ways Banana Tag could go that could form into something. But I think to that point of, like, Beacon, if you could get some revenue, could sit on its own for quite some time trying to figure out which path it was going to end up on. And I don't think any of those are bad. I think they all go back to what your ambitions are for the project. And it sort of goes back to something that you and I talked about offline, which was, how you would go about raising some level of money for this. And, you mentioned in pre-show that, maybe finding some sponsors, was a path. But I also think it's worth digging back into this thought process of, can you find one or two large customers who might drive the next five or six features and also bankroll the work you've already done?
I wanted to hear what you had to say before I maybe steered you in a certain way. So I'll tell you, and by the way, for anybody listening, if you have thoughts on this, I would love to hear them. So just email show@resultsjunkies.com or tweet at us, but yeah, I'd love to hear some more thoughts on how to bootstrap companies that have a non-zero startup cost like this. But my current thinking is that there's a two-pronged approach here. The first is that there's that sponsorship angle of the daily newsletter that'll go out. And again, I'm hoping to have that at least version 0.1 ready for people to use this week. And I've been talking to a couple other daily and weekly email list creators that do this as well. Not this, but like in similar spaces. Like hackernewsletter.com and a couple of the other ones. And what's interesting is that they all seem to be able, even with like modest signup numbers, modest, email list sizes, they're able to actually generate, $1,000 to $5,000 a week in terms of sponsorships. Now, I'm not saying that's easy, by the way, but that's kind of promising. So I think prong number one is like sponsors for the daily newsletter and for the various pages. But the other angle is pre-sales. I think that, my gut says that there may be a couple forward-thinking larger companies that might want to be the first in line to buy some of this stuff. So let's say there were like certain key phrases that they wanted to look for, Capital One Venture X card or whatever. I don't know. Then it's like, well, how do I go get those maybe one or two initial enterprise customers and actually, because that feature exists, by the way. I just need to have somebody that wants it so that I can actually justify really scaling that one up.
Sure.
Because it does cost. I mean, at my scale right now, maybe I'm opening the kimono too much here, but at my scale right now, which is not that big, you know, I've indexed about 600 million hours of content so far. Transcribing it is going to be just about a penny a minute. Now, it could be lower at scale, at a larger scale, but I'm sort of artificially holding myself back right now because what I don't want to do is end up with a $200,000 bill. You know, doesn't make sense to keep digging myself into the hole here. So anyway, I think my current thinking is sponsors on one side and a few enterprise early customers on the other. But if anybody has any other thoughts on this, I would love to hear about it because I think there's a lot of people out there working on, side projects or their next thing. And they are in that in-between space where it's a non-zero cost to start up, but also it's not something that either requires venture capital or maybe they're like me and they just don't want to go down that path.
Yeah. And I don't know if you remember, there was a newsletter that I sent your way a couple times, Pod News. And I think, to your point about sponsors, I think that Pod News uses that sort of a model where they're not really indexing like you are in terms of transcription and stuff like that. They're sort of indexing news in the podcasting world. And the guy that runs it is very knowledgeable about the podcasting space. So I do think there's a path there where you could use sponsors to sort of get where you want. I think the reason why I kind of like the idea of looking for a couple of pre-sale or large partners is I also think it can help drive direction for you, especially if you can move further up the food chain and who those folks are. I think back to a couple of things. One was at Podcast Movement a number of years ago, and the other was a friend and colleague that I have with a large bank. The Podcast Movement conference, I remember Nielsen did a presentation at Podcast Movement right back when I started my podcast, so probably about 4 years ago. And they talked about how at that point, podcasts weren't even part of the standard RFP for marketing campaigns, that they didn't even reach the level of like the other checkbox at the bottom of the page. And it was like when people do RFPs for national campaigns, they'd have radio and print and billboard and all this stuff. But nobody even really had podcasts in there because the folks who controlled the purse strings didn't see it as a viable way to sell product. I think that's changed a little bit. I obviously don't know if it's in these major RFPs. Nielsen has that info, not me. But I think to that point of, where is podcasting in the ecosystem where marketers think, do they see enough value in the medium to drive a portion of a big bucket of money to this? And I think the answer is yes, in a very small way, even if it's only 1% of that pie. And then the other piece is this, this theory and this feeling of, this contact I have, it's a major bank and she was mentioning a product that, a company that she has a partnership with. And I said, oh yeah, we talked about them on my podcast. This is my other podcast, Miles to Go, not Results Junkies. And she's like, oh, I didn't know that, I'll have to get back with my media people. And so she has, services and software that look for references for their products, amongst things that are in print on the internet. And clearly podcasts struggle with that. It's one of the reasons why we transcribe Results Junkies. And one of the reasons why I've transcribed Miles to Go for quite some time is that the internet sort of can't catch up with podcasts if they're not transcribed. They don't fit into this model that Google essentially built. So I think those are, a couple of like large, chunks of progress that I think you could make. Again, not sure how to go down those roads. But I think there's this discoverability piece that podcasting has always struggled with that hasn't been solved yet. But because of the energy and the eagerness over the past, let's call it 12 months about podcasting, there's been more of a desire to want to solve the discoverability piece of it.
Yeah. I mean, look, I in broad strokes, I think there are two kinds of podcast listeners. I think the first group is people that, you know, use it to listen long form. You know, maybe the people, for example, listening to this right now, you're in that first category of, hey, I'm doing something. I'm curious what Paul and Ed have to say, and I'm just going to listen to it. Thanks, by the way. And I think that's the predominant use case of podcasts. That first group is pretty large. And on the flip side of that, by the way, I think podcast producers look at that group, or they look at podcasts as a bottom of funnel thing because of that. You know, you've got to earn enough trust from your audience to get them to then spend 35 minutes listening to you. So that's kind of the paradigm of group one, if you will. But I think there's this group two that is not served very well. So for example, what you just mentioned there about your friend in the credit card industry, like how many nuggets are mentioned way deep in the podcast, but not mentioned in the show notes? So for example, you just mentioned the phrase Capital One or whatever credit card you just mentioned. That's not the topic of this podcast, but it's relevant to somebody that later on that might be looking for that phrase. And so I guess group two is people that could use podcasts as a way to learn something quicker. You know, just like right now when you have to go fix something in your plumbing, you might go to YouTube. I mean, right? A lot of people go to YouTube right away to figure out how to do something quickly. I think there's just a lot of nuggets buried deep inside podcasts that on their own may not make any sense, but you know, in the aggregate, if we could make them searchable and make them more interesting, it might help people solve problems. So like if you were, let's just say you were thinking about cost of acquisition, you know, we've talked about CAC quite a bit on this podcast. Like what if somebody could actually search for CAC, follow that topic and listen to the exact 30-second snippet across a bunch of different podcasts quickly and then decide if they want to follow our podcast, right? And then you go beyond that where it's like, what if the machine actually made new podcasts as with an aggregate of the same of that content from across a lot of different podcasts? So, you know, let's call it the CAC Weekly. I'm making this up, right? The CAC Weekly, and it's grabbing, you know, 2-minute segments from the top podcasts that talked about that over the last week, and now you can subscribe to that. And so I'm just really fascinated by what's possible here. But again, it goes back to you got to pay the bills and make sure you're not digging a big hole. So,
yeah. And I think, you know, when you talk about all this, like it gets back to this nugget of what's meaningful, and you have to show that meaningful value to whoever, whether that's a large corporation or a single person. And I think the meaningful part of podcasts, it's never been able to be reliably monetized, is the nuance. And what I mean by that is, you know, and I don't remember the number, but like there's been a stat that's been thrown around for years, and I don't know if it's accurate across the entire blogging industry, but at least for my blog, it's like, you know, average reading times for stories are measured in seconds and minutes. And there are averages out there that say like the average person spends less than a minute reading a blog post, yada, yada, yada. But, you know, like they're measured in seconds and minutes for a reason, because the average person doesn't spend 30 minutes reading a blog post, to the point of what you said about on the tour many times about how, you know, attention span of people and what we move on to and the next email alert pops up or the next tweet alert pops up. You know, podcast listeners consume, you know, minutes and hours of content. And so that's where I think the nuance comes in on an issue. And I think it's whether it's bottom of funnel or middle of funnel or top of funnel. And again, I think you and I both think that it's more middle and bottom of funnel for podcasts. There's this ability to sell to someone who's going to listen to more of the nuance. But how do you spin that into a model? And I think, you know, where Beacon fits into this niche of so many different startups I've seen in the podcast world that have come out is this ability to now say, all right, well, we can almost be like the middleware, if you will, of translating podcasts back to this textual nature and making them searchable, which, you know, expands this pool, because, and I don't know the numbers, but I imagine the vast majority of podcasts are not transcribed right now. And so they really just disappear after the episode's up, you know, especially because most platforms only keep you know, 50 or 100 episodes on the platform. So once shows get to some sort of age, they're just the content's gone.
Yep.
So how do you continue to, you know, like if I write a blog post today about how to travel to Iceland, the trip our family did, like that post lives on forever and Google's got it and it's searchable and all that good stuff. But the podcasting world just doesn't work that way. And so I think, you know, there's a problem to solve there.
That's just it, right? You know, like that content sort of disappears. But what if somebody wanted to travel to Iceland, plan a trip to Iceland 6 months from now? How do you find that? I don't know the answers, but I think directionally there's something there. And that I think is something that people should maybe keep in the back of their mind as we talk about, you know, side hustles and all these other things, is that, you know, it's the most important thing is not to be right, but rather to be directionally right. And I think that is kind of when I think about podcasts and what we're talking about here, neither you nor I know exactly what it's going to look like a year from now or a decade from now, but directionally, it's very interesting. And so I think that framework, by the way, is worth, you know, people keeping in their back pocket whenever they're thinking about stuff, right? You know, I think the world wants you to be exactly correct about everything, but you can't. So the key is to look for directionally accurate things. But yeah, I think it'll be interesting. Like podcasts aren't going to go away, that's for sure. But I think if we could unlock the content for people, like for example, I don't think my wife would listen, would ask, consider herself a podcast listener.
Right.
But, you know, if she's, well, let me say this a different way. Companies like Google and Facebook have built massive, massive revenue businesses based on user intent. So, I mean, you know this, I'm sure everybody knows this, but just to kind of explain it, you know, if you think about Google revenue, right, most of that comes from their ad business. Well, that ad business is really based on, and just in simple terms here, it's based on search terms. So if I type in 65-inch TV, you might not care. But if I typed in Sony Bravia 65-inch TV, that's interesting because now that first search kind of implies that I'm looking at all 65-inch TVs. There's no buying intent probably. I'm just kind of like figuring it out. But the second search is like Sony Bravia 65-inch TV. Maybe I'm looking for a help manual. Maybe I'm looking to see who sells it, right? The intent is there. My point here is that coming back to podcasts and all that, like, you know, group one of podcast listeners, which are the predominantly served today, are the people that are, you know, listening to this because they want to know what you and I think. They're already bought into our audience. And that's what podcast producers are writing or building towards. But what I think I'm directionally accurate with is this idea that there is also a second group that is not currently addressed. These are people that are they may or may not self-describe as podcast listeners, but when they have high intent, when they say, I want to plan a trip to Iceland, in addition to all the other blog posts and whatever, they ought to be able to find your podcast and they ought to be able to find all podcasts around that topic and then listen to the 30 or 50 second clip of each of those podcasts before they decide to go all in to Miles to Go. And I think that could help drive more discoverability for you as a podcast creator, but I think it drives tremendous value for people that, you know, would benefit from knowing how to do that. Cause you know, the other side of this, by the way, if you haven't figured it out, I am very interested in SEO these days, search engine optimization, because I think like even my own Google searches are getting really noisy. You know, like I think a big reason why people go to YouTube to learn something as opposed to like text-based sites anymore is because the text game is just totally gamed now.
Yeah.
Right? Yep. Like the top 10 search results on Google, DuckDuckGo, whatever, are not often the best. They're often the best optimized for the machine to put it there. And then you and I look at it and we're like, what? This doesn't tell me how to fix that drain plug. And then I just click the refine button and I say, show me videos within the last hour or the last year, you know? And I think it's the same with podcasts. Like it's hard to game YouTube. It's hard to game podcasts. It's hard to game all this stuff. So anyway, now that I've kind of ranted about this, you can tell I've been thinking quite a bit about this. there's something there. And if people have ideas on how to bootstrap these sort of companies, I'd love to hear it. But also, if you find this stuff interesting, I hope by the time you listen to this, you're going to go to getbeacons.com. So that's GETBEACONS.com, and check it out. See if it works for you. And email me and tell me what sucks. I'll make it better.
Yeah. And I think, like, for me, the reason why I'm excited about Beacon, sort of goes back to a question. I know you quoted those numbers on the tour of how many companies you've invested in, massive number, thousands. How many companies were you personally involved with investing money in where the investment happened without you ever having a conversation with the founder?
If I understand the question...
Yeah, going back to the beginning, not like I understand things got bigger and you had people on your team who helped vet companies. But when you were making an investment, how many times did you invest in someone without like talking to them via phone or in person?
Zero.
Right.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. It was always yeah.
Yeah. You want to look them in the eye, or you want to hear, you want to understand the passion, all that stuff. I don't know that. And you and I talk about it. Like you like we're out on the road because we're looking at companies, or we're talking to people, or, you know, all your trips to Peoria, all that stuff has value. And Zoom's never going to make that go away. It doesn't mean that we're not going to travel less and we're use Zoom for things, all that stuff. But this sort of nuance is core to who we are as human beings. It's mm-hmm. this belief system. It's our gut. It's whatever it is. Like we need to understand it, and we need to understand the person and connect with them. It's why you and I have our cameras on right now, so we can mm-hmm. look at each other while we're talking. And to that point, like, whether it's called podcasting or video or short form or whatever it's called, you know, we're always going to have personal interactions. And the problem with them right now is, and maybe this sounds a little bit biased, maybe it makes me sound too kitschy about the podcast world, but I don't think the podcast world is necessarily broken in terms of what we discuss and how we pitch ideas to folks, and, you know, what comes out of it, the value that comes out of somebody listening to, you know, 40 minutes of a Results Junkies episode. The problem is that the way everybody else, this goes back to what you just said about SEO, the way everybody else tweaks their algorithms pushes down the value of the 40 minutes that you and I just created. And Beacon has the ability to turn that back into the gold that the last 40 minutes was. And maybe that sounds a bit arrogant in terms of what we're producing here. Like, I don't think we're solving the world's problems. I think we're making people ask questions, and those questions make them better founders, better entrepreneurs. And, you know, Beacon has the ability to expose this 40-minute conversation to more people so that they ask themselves tougher questions before they quit their job or take money from mom to build, you know, what they think is the best thing they could ever build.
It'll be interesting to see how this all goes. And, you know, I will admit, by the way, that Beacon's not going to do all this on day one, you know, but it will. These are interesting problems. And I think... Anyway, I'm excited to see what you think of this thing and what others think as well. And like I said, by the time this thing gets published, there should be a sign up page, and you'll be able to use version one of this thing and tell me what you think.
All right, I think that's a good place to put a pin in it. But maybe with one last thing, I think, like, July, you know, when this episode drops, July 14th, let's make that the day that we start calling them side projects.
I like
side
that.
Hustles.
I like that.
Maybe we'll come up with something better, but side hustle still just doesn't. I think it undersells the amount of time and energy somebody like you puts into a project like this.
I love that. Side projects it is. Unless somebody has a better idea, you tweet at us or send me an email, or send us an email, show@resultsjunkies.com. What should we call side hustles? We're going to go with side projects unless anybody else comes up with something better. All right, man. Well, happy to have you back, although it sounds like 60 hours from now you're back on another airplane, which sounds grueling.
I did not have on my bingo card that I would be done with United 1K in June of this year, but I am now officially requalified, and there is nothing inside me that's happy about that development.
I love it. All right, man. Well, safe travels, and tell the family I said hello.
All right, man. Take it easy.